Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is a Marvel Monday episode, and today I'm going to be talking about a few Marvel books I got to read recently, as well as continuing an in-depth look on Charles Soule's Daredevil run with Daredevil number 18. But let me start first with a new number one issue that I got to read recently. It's the Black Widow number one from writers Jen and Sylvia Soska. Creative sisters, they've directed films, they're very much into comics and geek culture, if you will. And this is their take on the Black Widow. The art is by somebody named Flaviano, not familiar with his work or hadn't been prior to this issue. We've got color work by Veronica Gandini, letters by Joe Caramagna, and the cover art is by Clayton Crane. And I want to talk about that cover art first before I dive into the issue. Normally, I'm a huge fan of Clayton Crane. His stuff is digitally painted. It's very dynamic and very beautiful. And 99 times out of 100, I'm going to love it. This cover, however, I don't know. Like, it just didn't do it for me. The colors are kind of muted and washed out. Black Widow's body position, her head looks, I don't know. I was really surprised. You know, I recognize it as Clayton Crane, but I didn't understand what it was about this piece that I didn't like. I mean, her arms look a little too thin. Her head doesn't look like it's in proportion to her body. I don't know. It was really strange for me. I mean, normally I hear a Clayton Crane on a cover and I'm like, yeah, I can't wait. And I have looked at the cover for issue 2, which is also done by Clayton Crane, and it looks spectacular. I'm like, oh yeah, there's the Clayton Crane I know. So I'm not sure what happened here. So I don't know if anybody else looked at it and thought, why does she look so weird? Let me know, because I'd be curious. Is it just me, or did other people feel that it looked kind of weird? But anyway, for those that aren't aware, the Black Widow was killed by the evil version of Captain America, the Hydra version, as it were. Of course, as always, comic heroes never really stay dead. So the Red Room, which is the kind of clandestine KGB organization that trained Natasha Romanoff to become a spy or an assassin in the first place, revives her as a clone, and they implant memories in her. Eventually she breaks free, she destroys the Red Room, as well as the remaining clones, but the world at large still thinks she's dead. So, in a way, she's back, but now living in the shadows as a dead woman or a ghost is kind of the blurb that we get inside the front cover there. So the story starts off, it's New York City, it's New Year's Eve, it's Times Square, the ball's gonna drop, Captain America's there, people are giving him crap, still hailing Hydra, Captain America, not my captain, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, it's interesting because this is 100% accurate, the way people would give Captain America a bunch of grief, even though it was a, you know, different version, not actually this Captain America that was evil from alternate timeline kind of thing. And so he's there to go to this party, and part of the reason he's there is that there's supposedly a group of Chernian, I think is how you would announce. I mean, you think Chechenian, but obviously you're not going to use real place. Marvel likes to make up analogs for those kind of places. But while Captain America's riding up in the elevator, Black Widow says, hey, there's a group of terrorists targeting this event, and one's impersonating you to sow discord. And Captain America's like, yeah, that's why I have to be here, to put in the FaceTime. There's been more than enough false Steve Rogers lately for my taste. And Black Widow's like, yeah, two caps means people are going to question what they've seen. But if we don't stop the fake before he does any real damage, then it may already be too late. So she's going to go investigate another floor of the building, because apparently there's been a lot of chatter about a robot army, and then she'll check back in with Captain America. So Captain America reaches the top floor, opens up, and we see the fake Captain America standing there saying society is a disease, none more so than democracy. Democracy must be destroyed for man's true righteous might to be revealed. And it's like, man, how could anybody, I don't care how drunk you are on New Year's Eve, how could anybody believe that crap would come out of Captain America's mouth? Maybe because of the fake cap recently, you know, kind of sowing ideas of fascism and stuff, but I just don't see it. Like, nobody who knows or has seen the real Captain America, especially if you actually live in the Marvel Universe where the real Captain America exists, you're not going to buy that. So as Captain America is about to confront this fake version of Captain America, he's asking Widow what her situation is, and she gets to the dark floor, as she calls it, and she sees that, yes, there's a bunch of security all tied up, there's a giant mechanical looking spider thing, and she's going to have to take all those guys out, and there's a lot of mercenaries guarding them, and Captain America reminds her, no killing. It's like, they can't see my face. Everybody thinks I'm dead. If I don't kill them, they could report to people that I'm still around. Cap's like, no killing. You're a spy, right? So isn't that what you do? So Cap continues to confront the fake Cap while Natasha puts on a disguise of appearing to wear a blindfold and having her hands tied behind her back. So she kind of appears to be just another one of the hostages, and gets ready to attack the mercenaries. So meanwhile, Captain America's at the party kind of calling everybody out, going, you listen to this phony spout all the garbage about might makes right, and you thought that's what Captain America might stand for? And some of the party goers are like, well, honestly, it's getting kind of hard to tell. Somebody else says, yeah, I thought he was making a lot of sense. Cap's like, man, what's it take to get you people to realize there's something wrong? And all of a sudden, the fake Captain America unveils some Ameribots, he calls them, and starts firing at the real Captain America with some onlookers saying, yeah, take that pinko cap, right? It's always that. It's always socialism when people just want to be empathetic to other people and have some unity. So very, very political. It's interesting that the Soska sisters take it in this direction. So meanwhile, as the Widow appears or pretends to have her hands tied behind her back and does have a blindfold on, she approaches a couple of the mercenaries and they tell her to sit down before the mercenaries can even finish the sentence. She takes them out with a couple of Widow stings, starts freeing all the hostages, telling them to head down the elevator, and then tries to access the giant robot spider. Captain America then shows up and he says, well, that's a really big party favor you got there. Good work freeing the hostages and taking out the goons. And she says, yeah, obviously you took care of things upstairs. He says, oh, nothing beats the real thing. And then starts to sneak up behind her. It's so obvious that this is not actually Captain America, that it's the fake. And it's obvious to Natasha too, because as he tries to sneak up behind her, she gives him an elbow to the face, and unfortunately the robot then comes to life, breaks through the floor of the ceiling, and heads up toward the top of the skyscraper where the ball's going to drop, with Black Widow in hot pursuit. So the fake Captain America recovers and prepares to detonate this robot and take out all these people in Times Square, but Natasha takes him out with a garrote. She's about to strangle him to death, is what it really looks like, when Steve Rogers shows up, tells her, that's enough, we don't kill. And she starts to argue with him, and his response is, we don't kill. If I hadn't stopped you, and she's like, so? Don't they all come back anyway? He was going to kill all those people down there. I died. I came back. You died. You came back. And Cap says, it doesn't matter. There's a line that we don't cross. That's what separates us from them. And Natasha argues, you know, she says, you know, some people aren't made right, Steve. There's only one way to fix them. It's not your way. It's not this gentle way of, you know, put them in jail and put them on trial and this and that. And it just doesn't work. Your way doesn't work. And Cap says, it's not my way, it's our way. And I know things haven't been good for a while, but we both still need to be true to who we are. We can't let the evil of this world drag us down to its level. We're better than that. And Widow argues again, you know, maybe you're better than that, Cap, but I am what I am. Anyway, I think I'm done for the night. Have fun playing the hero. I'm still dead, so I'm going to go ahead and get out of here. And as she leaves, she reminds him, and you killed me, Steve. Like, you're talking about don't kill and, you know, don't cross that line, but you killed me. See, obviously, you know, it wasn't him. It was that alternate version of him, but still, that's not something she's going to forget. So the next day, she's kind of thinking to herself, you know, everything that's happened, Steve killing me, destroying so much of my past. I can feel it rising up inside me again, the violence, the rage. I've held it down, but it won't last much longer. It's part of why she was wanting to kill that guy. There's something in her that seems to crave that violence. Maybe it's part of her training. But what she decides is that she can't stay in New York. She needs a release. She needs a place where she can let go and kind of follow that killer instinct before she hurts somebody who doesn't deserve it. So she needs to go out there and find somebody who does deserve it. So she travels in disguise, obviously, to a place where she can let loose, where things are a little more rough and tumble. She heads to Madripoor, famously the stomping grounds of Logan's alter ego, Wolverine's alter ego, Patch. So she heads there, and she's kind of hanging out. She dresses up like what Patch would actually dress as. You know, she's got the white suit and the eye patch, and she's kind of wandering around, and it doesn't take too long before trouble finds her. But that's exactly what she wants, right? She wants to get in a little trouble so she can cut loose. So she talks to an escort and is asking if Madame Joy treats her well. And the escort says, yes, better than most. It's not the madams we have to look out for. And Natasha says, well, who do you have to look out for? And all of a sudden, there's some thugs behind her saying, us. And they want to know why Natasha's been walking around dressed like that, looking for trouble. You know who runs this island? And Black Widow responds, me. And starts taking them out, thinking, you know, Madripoor used to be a safe haven for pirates back in the day. It's not really safe for anyone anymore, but that's the point. You know, she talks about how she doesn't even break a sweat fighting against these guys. And again, this is exactly why she went to Madripoor, exactly what she was looking for, a reason to cut loose. So she takes out these four thugs pretty easily. She doesn't even break a sweat, in her own words. And there's a figure in the shadow saying, I don't know whether to arrest you or thank you. But that depends, are you a friend or a foe? And Natasha says, a friend. And this woman says, of whose? And she says, Logan, you know, Patch. And the woman responds, well, Logan's dead. I love it. Natasha says, yeah, there's been a lot of that going around lately. And the woman says, well, red hair, violent, questionable fashion choices, you're definitely his type. And Natasha says, well, it wasn't like that. And the woman replies, state your business. So this is Tiger, Jason Hone, closest thing Madripoor has to Law and Order, which makes her someone not to mess with. And Black Widow wants to speak privately. So they head to the Princess Bar, and we find out that Tiger knows who she is. She even refers to her as Miss Romanoff. She said, you know, my cybersecurity man picked you up as soon as you got to the island. Why would there be a dead Avenger on my island? And Natasha starts to explain herself. She said, well, not Avenger anymore. I'm not even alive officially. I'm just a weapon looking for a target. Again, it's that killer instinct that she feels rising up inside her. She's looking for a way to channel it, to funnel it, to use it for some good, so she doesn't inadvertently hurt somebody who's innocent. So Tiger and her tech guys inform Jessica about this group called the No Restraints Play. They've been kidnapping Madripoor children, and they have a website on the dark web for anybody who's got enough money and who's sick enough and depraved enough to watch somebody else torture these kids, basically. They announce the broadcast to the site members, and they have a time limit to pledge, and the highest bidder becomes the director. and they basically tell these horrible people what to do to these kids. So Natasha's horrified by this. She immediately gets up from the table, walks over to the bar and grabs a bottle of booze, starts drinking. And Tiger's asking for help. She says, you know, someone's stealing our children, performing unspeakable acts. I need your help to bring them to justice. And Natasha says, justice? There's no justice for someone who could do such a thing, and to children, no less. So she is actually happy that she was contacted by Tiger, and happy that this has fallen in her lap in a way. And she thinks to herself, you know, Cap would be horrified, but somewhere deep inside me, there's a part of me that's smiling, because with these kind of disgusting monsters, men that would do this, I can finally let loose. I can let my monster out. I can be the killer I was made to be. So as Tiger says, let's not waste any time. Let's, start trying to track these guys down. They walk outside, and Tiger says, it'd be great if you could catch them tonight. I want to be the one to watch them die. And as they are saying that and they walk out, we see that the head of the No Restraints play is there, has already tracked down Miss Romanoff. And he says, I've come for the redhead who took it upon herself to snoop around my business, my women, and damage my men. The two of us were going to play No Restraints play. So don't know what this guy's name is. He looks pretty ridiculous. With his hair is like, he's got a pink top knot / mohawk, and then the sides are straight and green, and then as they fall onto his shoulders, they're blonde and curly. Like, yeah, this guy, he looks pretty ridiculous. Knee pads and big bubble shoulders, and just, he looks retarded. He really does. So, to be continued. But it certainly looks like Natasha is going to get exactly what she was hoping for when she came to Madripoor, which is a way to cut loose some really, really terrible people that she gets to not worry about their safety. So that's how the story ends. I do encourage you, if you do pick it up, to certainly read the letter from the Soska sisters in the back. It talks about how excited they are to be writing Black Widow, how they grew up reading Marvel comics, and how Natasha was one of their favorites. And so I do feel like they have a very strong and clear idea of who Natasha is and what the journey is that they want to take her on. And it's really getting back to the very early roots of the character, you know, buying into that idea of being trained by, you know, the secret Russian organization, KGB, as it were, back in the day, but then now, you know, retcon to the Red Room. And it makes a lot of sense that she, ever since she died and came back, she's felt a little lost. She's not sure who she is anymore. So, again, really great story. Thought the artwork was pretty solid by Flaviano. I don't know if he did the design work for this leader of the No Resistance play, but I do find him to be pretty ridiculous and over the top. But for the most part, it's strong, strong line work. Not my favorite art, a little stylized. The storytelling from panel to panel is a little subdued, I'll say. Just a little static. Even in the fight scenes, there's not as much sense of movement as somebody a little more polished, maybe. So it might just be a matter of getting Flaviano more work. So, not sure. Guess we'll have to wait and see on that. But I did enjoy the issue. I was really impressed with the Soska sisters' handle on writing a comic. I think they did a really great job. And it felt like Natasha. Her voice sounded and felt very authentic. It's a different version of the Black Widow than we've seen, or maybe ever, but certainly for a long, long time, since her earliest appearances, you know. A hero that's really looking to cut loose, to allow that killer instinct to manifest, right? I mean, heroic in that she's going to funnel it and channel it rather than just losing control against somebody like the fake Captain America that we saw in the early part of the issue. One other thing I'll say is it's paced pretty quickly. It is interesting that we do get basically two acts. You know, we get the first half with the party in New York with Captain America. It feels like its own thing. And then we get the early time in Madripoor for Natasha. So it definitely felt very cinematic in that way. Like, here's the opening scene. Almost think of it like a cool-looking early action sequence for like a James Bond movie, and that then you turn the page, we get to Madripoor, and now you're getting into the main part of the story. So again, I thought it was handled really, really well. All right, up next we have Daredevil: Man Without Fear number 3. This is written by Jed McKay with art by Eben Cabello, colors by Andris Mosa, and letters by Clayton Cowles. So I don't know what to think of this Man Without Fear series. I'll talk more about how I feel about it overall when we get to issue 5. I just find it strange that we're going from Charles Soule's run to Chip Zdarsky's run, but instead of going from one writer to the other, from one month to the next, we're getting the 6-week break where we're substituting a Daredevil weekly series in between that's not written by either Soule or Zdarsky. Yeah, it doesn't make sense. So we know that Matt Murdock at the end of Soule's run got hit by a truck, saving somebody's life, much like the same way he gained his powers. And Matt wanted to quit being Daredevil. Looked like he wanted to give up on life altogether, maybe live out his life in a wheelchair, maybe with his former girlfriend, maybe not. We saw last issue in issue 2 where he really was confronting the ghosts, if you will, of girlfriend's past, which if you know anything about Daredevil, that's a pretty big list, and it's always resulted in tragedy for Matt, with maybe the exception of the Mark Waid run where he seemed to have a relationship that made him happy that didn't end in tragedy, I'll put it that way. But like I said, last issue, Man Without Fear 2, he realizes that he's still a lightning rod for danger, and he kind of pushes away his girls. So this one starts off, Matt is working in the gym in the rehab center. He's trying to learn to walk again, and we see that Danny Rand shows up there, Iron Fist, and they're talking about the fact that Matt's thinking about giving it up or planning on giving up being Daredevil, and Iron Fist is not buying it, like, fine, you're quitting as Daredevil. I just don't see it. And, you know, as he collapses into his wheelchair, he says, look at me, do I have a choice? And Danny's like, again, like, dude, let me set you up with top of the line rehab place, please. You shouldn't still be in the hospital working on this stuff, you know? You should be in top of the line place where you can get better quicker, I can help you. And Matt's like, no. When I was a kid, I grew up in Capuzzo's gym where my dad trained, and the place was a dump. And this is how that place felt. It feels like home. Now help me to the bars. He's going to take another try at walking. And then we get a flashback. There's a new Fool Killer in town, and we see that Daredevil has recruited Iron Fist and Jessica Jones and Luke Cage to help him with this new Fool Killer, who has been threatening Ben Urich, who's been a friend to Daredevil. And then we flash back. So that's how this whole issue runs. It's dual narrative. It's the story of Daredevil and Iron Fist and Power Man and Jessica Jones stopping or trying to guard Ben Urich from the new Fool Killer, while those same people discuss in current time where Matt is at currently and if he'll continue to be Daredevil. So it's now Power Man's turn to try to cheer up Matt in current times. And unlike Iron Fist, Power Man actually thinks Matt's doing the right thing. He's like, you ain't asked, but I think you're doing the right thing. And Matt says, what, by turning down Danny to have a fancy rehab place? He said, no, by retiring. And Matt says, well, Danny called it quitting. Paraman's like, yeah, but Danny doesn't listen to half of what comes out of his mouth. And I know Matt Murdock. Matt Murdock's got no quit. Matt Murdock's got no fear. So why would he be quitting? It's almost like Power Man knows that if he goes at it the way Danny Rand did, the way Iron Fist did, like, dude, you can't quit. You're not that guy. That you know, because Matt's a very stubborn guy. That's just going to make Matt dig in his heels instead. So he's trying. It's almost like he's trying a little reverse psychology. Yeah, man, I think you're doing the right thing retiring. Because, you know, I know Matt Murdock, and Matt Murdock ain't got no quit. He ain't got no fear. So you must not even be Matt Murdock. You know, again, he's trying to get under his skin a little bit. So we flash back to guarding Ben Urich, and we're getting a little bit of just a little exposition, just a little setup. Here's what this Fool Killer is. Here's what the setup is. Here's how we're gonna guard Ben Urich. Meanwhile, back in present day, it's Jessica Jones' turn to come in and confront Matt about quitting. And Jessica says, yeah, Luke calls it retiring, but, you know, Luke used to put on the big, scary, bulletproof John Shaft act. So what does Luke know? But he's a nurturer, and that's what his whole protector shtick is about. He thinks he used to have to hide being a badass, but you don't. You don't have to. And she goes on to say, and that's the same thing goes for you, Matt. You don't have to put on that act. You don't have to put on that mask, at least not with your friends. You don't have to pretend that you have no fear. You can show us what's underneath. Like, and again, I think all Daredevil's friends, all three of them, they're trying to understand. They're trying to let him know that they are there for him. Like, whatever it is that you need, Matt, we're there for you. So, meanwhile, we flash back again, and it's narration by the Fool Killer, and he's talking about how it's all about preparation. It's what separates someone like me from the fools. Urch is going to be so scared. Even called in some super pals. And despite all their precautions to guard Ben Urch, the Fool Killer has a way in, and he's going to be able to sneak past all the heroes. So meanwhile, back at the hospital gym, Danny's kind of praising Matt, saying, the progress, you've made it, you know, really far, but you've been beaten up for how many years? So you got to appreciate the progress, no matter how little it is, and you'll get there. And Matt says, yeah, you know, you're probably right, but can you fix me? And Iron Fist is like, fix you? It's like, yeah, with your kung fu, with your chi, can you fix me? And Danny's like, no, I can't fix you. Maybe if it had just been the truck, but, you know, you have strata of injury. The truck and the operations, that's one thing, but you have years and years of piled up damage. And I know you can hear everything because you're a Daredevil and that's your power, this, you know, super hearing. Listen to your body for once. Listen to what your body is telling you. So it's interesting. They want to be there for Matt. They want what's best for him. It's clear they care for him. None of them are saying, you need to be Daredevil. You need to keep doing it. You need to keep being a hero. Because I think at the end of the day, they care more about Matt as a person than they do about him being Daredevil. I think they all feel that Matt will become Daredevil again because it's who he is and it's what's going to be best for him to be true to himself, but they're not pushing it. So I do like that McKay is kind of laying it out there, and it's a very kind of realistic reaction from his friends on how they're treating him, despite the fact that he's currently stuck in a wheelchair and he has all these, you know, injuries that he's trying to recover from. So meanwhile, back in the past, we see Jessica Jones and Luke Cage are sitting outside Ben Urich's apartment door, and they're kind of just bantering back and forth. And all of a sudden they start to feel really tired. Like, wow, why am I so tired? It's only 9 o'clock. Come to find out they've been gassed by the Fool Killer. And they both fall out of their chairs. Speaking of falling, in the present day, Matt is going through the bars, trying to walk again, slips and falls. Luke is able to catch him before he hits the ground, and is trying to persuade Matt that that's enough for tonight. And Matt says, "You never retired, did you? Even when the government said you had to?" He said, "No, but it was a hard choice, and you didn't either, if I remember correctly." And Matt says, "No, I actually made Danny be Daredevil." He's like, "Oh yeah, I forgot about that. Between you and me, costume-wise, that was a step up. I think he wanted to keep it. But get better, man, if you want that costume again. I'm sure Danny will give it back." Matt, nope, he can have it. Still thinks he's gonna give up. Meanwhile, in the flashback, Daredevil senses there's something wrong. They can't get a hold of Jessica or Luke on the phone. So they head into Ben Urich's apartment, where the Fool Killer has shown up and is about to attack Urich. In present day, Matt's saying no. Danny's like, "What? No. You're not going to give it a go once?" "No, Danny, I'm wrecked. I'm broken, destroyed, ruined." Like, okay, night off, no big deal. Probably good for you, really. He's like, you don't get it. None of you get it. I'm not going to be Daredevil anymore. I'm not. What do I even need to learn to walk again or be able to walk again? I'm not going to get better. So interesting here. It's like it's that two-edged sword of stubbornness, right? Like could be this. Matt could use his stubbornness to say, no matter what, I'm not going to give up. I'm going to walk again. And at the same time, he's too stubborn to even try because he's sick of trying. He's sick of not getting better. And Danny can't believe it. He's like, "I can't believe you're giving up. You're not even going to try. You're the toughest person I know." And Matt's response is, "New. Toughest person you knew." Like he's saying he wasn't even that person anymore. Meanwhile, Urich tries to defend himself with a kitchen knife from the Fool Killer. And just as the Fool Killer is about to shoot him in the face, Daredevil pops in and shows up and is able to prevent the Fool Killer. He doesn't even attack him. He just stands there and stares him down, saying, "You want the devil? You got him. What are you going to do?" Like holds the gun, grabs the gun from the barrel of the gun from the Fool Killer and puts it right there on his forehead, saying, "Come on, do it. What are you going to choose? The ground or the mental ward? What are you going to choose? Only one person gets to be the devil in the city." And it really shows the bravery that Daredevil has, that Matt Murdock has, about never giving up. Meanwhile, it's Jessica Jones' turn to confront Matt about not only quitting being Daredevil, which I think they would be okay with, but what they're not okay with is him not being true to himself, him quitting on himself. I think that's what the story is trying to say. And again, if being true to himself means not being Daredevil and being alive, I think they would all choose that. But to see Matt just retreat inside himself to the point where he's not even going to walk again, no. And Jessica says, "What's this supposed to be? Aren't you walking the rails in your head now? Is this a ninja thing?" And Matt says, "No, this is the giving up thing. I'm never going to walk properly again, so why waste my time?" And she reminds him, "You're Matt Murdock. Nothing's ever gone right for you, but that's what your superpower is. No matter what goes wrong, you keep going. No one in this game is as tough as you." And Matt's like, "You know what? Maybe I ran out of tough. Like, how much pain, how much do I have to go through? I give up." Jessica's like, "Nah, I don't know. But I know pain, and I know about getting up in the morning. And I remember the Fool Killer and what you did. You wouldn't give up. And that Matt Murdock wasn't afraid of anything, right? That Matt Murdock took the barrel of the gun, the Fool Killer's gun, and put it against his forehead. You wanted the devil, you got him. What are you going to do? Two Fool Killers are already in the grave. One in the mental ward. What will you choose?" Right? I mean, that takes guts. So much guts. And as Daredevil is confronting the Fool Killer in Ben Urich's apartment, all Iron Fist and Luke Cage and Jessica Jones can do is just look on, you know? Like, what? This guy is crazy. This guy really does have no fear. And Jessica's reminding Matt of that, saying, you put a .357 to your head with some lunatic's finger on the trigger and you didn't even blink. And then it dawns on her. She's like, that's it. Holy crap, you've lost it. You're afraid. Matt Murdock is afraid. No more man without fear. That's the difference. And Matt tells her to get out, and she's like, that's it. You're too scared to even try. You're so scared of failing to try to get better that you don't even want to try. And Matt screams at her to get out, and as she walks away, she goes, well, I guess that answers the question, right? That's what's under your badass act, fear. So, interesting take. Is that what's always been on underneath? What has always been underneath this facade of no fear? I mean, I always felt like Matt just did whatever he had to do. And it wasn't that he was fearless, even though obviously Daredevil Man Without Fear was always the name. I never looked at him like that. You know, the same way Green Lantern over on the DC side, you know, supposedly early on in the origin, the ring sought out somebody with, you know, great willpower and without fear. And then Geoff Johns changed it to, it wasn't the fact that they were never afraid. It's the fact that they had the ability to overcome that fear. I always saw Daredevil and Matt Murdock as different than that. It's not that he has the ability to overcome fear or that he doesn't have fear. It's that he's so committed to doing what's right. He's so committed to justice and protecting the little guy. He doesn't have time to be afraid. He doesn't even consider that he might be afraid. He's so focused, laser focused. And again, that's where that stubbornness comes in. He's so focused on what he needs to do. He's so focused on saving the day or stopping the villain or whatever. He never lets his brain go there. He never stops to experience any fear. He's too busy concentrating on what he needs to do, using all of his senses. Maybe it's the fact that all his other senses are jacked up to 11 that drowns out any fear that a normal person would have to acknowledge. A normal person would have that voice of fear in the back of their head saying, you can't jump off this building, you might die. He's not doing that. He's jumping off the building and he's sensing the air currents rushing by his skin. He's listening to the way the sounds echo off the buildings. He's, smelling the birds in the air to know where they are. You know, all those different things. He's doing all, it's so much input. He doesn't have time to hear that voice. That's the way I kind of always thought about Daredevil. He's always so busy and so focused on what he's doing, he doesn't have time to acknowledge that the fear even exists. So maybe what we're seeing here with what happened at the end of the Charles Soule run is that he's so broken and so defeated that he doesn't have anything to focus on. He doesn't have someone to rescue. He doesn't have a villain to defeat, unless you want to talk about it being fear itself. So he's finally, for the first time in his life, hearing that voice of fear. I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm just putting too much on this and giving it more credit than what it deserves. Like I said, I'll talk more in detail about how I feel about the whole series overall once I get to the last issue. Because I'm not even going to say that because I don't want to spoil. But yeah, I did enjoy this issue. I thought the first couple were the weakest ones. I thought this was one of the stronger ones. I definitely like the dual narrative and the flashing back with that that scene is so powerful with him taking the barrel of the Fool Killer's gun and holding it up to his forehead, you know, just daring him, go ahead and shoot me. So yeah, I thought that was pretty cool. It was a great scene. So yeah, I guess that's all I have to say about this issue. Again, I have a lot more to say about the overall, and I may even do a spotlight on it just because I think it's so interesting what Marvel chose to do. Don't know why they chose to do it. Don't know if I think this is even a quality comic at this point, but we'll, like I said, we'll talk more about it in detail later. All right, next up we have Invaders, number one. It's written by Chip Zdarsky. We have art by Carlos Magno with Butch Geis. Colors are by Alex Guimarães, and letters are by Travis Lanham. So this is exactly what it sounds like, Invaders. So back in World War II, we had Captain America, we had Bucky Barnes, we had Namor the Submariner, original Human Torch. And during the darkest hours of World War II, they banded together, they fought the Axis powers, and that's the story that we're being told here. We get some scenes in World War II with Namor and the rest of the heroes trying to fight off some Nazis. We see Namor early on kind of losing it a little bit. It's been too long since he's gone without water, which is a thing that used to be a little more prominent back in the day in the Silver Age with Namor. And even though they won, there were consequences. You know, they're fighting along other normal soldiers, you know, human soldiers that cannot not take the amount of punishment that these heroes can. And we even see on the first page, somebody, one of the soldiers, being helped by Namor because he was injured so badly. So this is another, kind of like the last story, another dual narrative. We switch to the now, and we see that Namor is awakened in his royal chambers, and they're talking about the nightmare that Namor just had. He was thinking back to those invader days, and Namor's right-hand man here, Makan, I think is how you would pronounce it, M-A-C-H-A-N, is telling him, you have the power of the seven seas, knowledge of the surface world. Soon you'll have the world's greatest army. Your plan is perfection. Your ship is ready, King Namor. When you are, the world will be yours. Meanwhile, in Avengers Mansion, we see Captain America going through some training. We see Jim Hammond there, the original Human Torch. Apparently, he's writing a book about the invaders, and he's there to see what Cap remembers about the war, and he's going to write about it. And Cap's like, you know, I'm sorry, I don't really remember that much. You know, part of it might have to do with it being so long ago. Part of it might have to do with him being frozen in ice for so long. And he says to Jim Raymond, you know, I'm kind of surprised you even need my help. You would think you, being an android, would have perfect recollection. And he said, yeah, but it turns out that the man who made me, Professor Horton, understood the intrinsic part of being human, which is forgetting. And so it turns out my memories fade kind of the same way everybody else's do. So that's why I'm here, to kind of refresh my memory. And they are talking about Namor and how he seems to have kind of gone off the rails recently. And, you know, he kidnapped and murdered the Roxxon employees. We saw that in a recent issue of Avengers. And Raymond says, well, you know, I think it's obvious that he thinks he's at war again. Like, people are killed during wartime, and those killings stay with us. And I think for me and you, the war ended. But I think for Namor, maybe it didn't, in a way. So he talks about the fact he's headed to Randall's place next. That's the soldier we saw injured on the first page. And he's going to see what he remembers of Namor. And Hammond even says, he was the one, Steve. Even after World War II, Namor roamed the Earth as an amnesiac. And I think that did something to him. Something happened to Namor. And you know better than anyone that things aren't always what they seem. So I want my book to show Namor as he was, you know, as he was back then when he really was a hero, because he does seem to be different now, and maybe all he needs is people who understand him to save him, to bring him back to what he was before. He was our friend. He is our friend. And then we flash back again to that time in World War II where we see that they did in fact win the battle, but there were losses, including Tommy, a kid that they couldn't imagine losing, you know, somebody that was really close to Namor. And a lot of the soldiers have gone into town for a little R&R, and Human Torch, Jim Raymond tells Cap, I don't even think Namor's coming to the burial. So Captain America tracks Namor down in this bar. He's there. He's drinking. He's kind of cuddling up to one of the local French girls there. And Captain America confronts him saying, you know, we're going to have this burial. Don't you think that you should be there? And Namor, and you can sense this is out of grief and out of loss. He's trying to distance himself. He says, you're going to bury them because that's what you do. And then you honor them. And this is your way, not mine. Am I supposed to be weepy over the deaths of your kind? Do you have any idea what it's like for me? How easily I could crush a man's head like an egg? You know, I'm running around on the battlefield trying to protect bags of water from being punctured by other bags of water. You want me to get attached and get weepy? I'm only here to stop these Nazis so they don't bring their war to my seas. Captain America doesn't buy it any more than we do. Again, it's clearly this loss of this soldier Tommy has clearly affected Namor, right? He lost a friend, and he's just trying to put up a wall. So Captain America says, you know what? Tommy was your friend, and this war has stolen your friend, but it can't steal your memories of him or the love you feel. And they're going to be burying him and the others at sundown, so why don't you honor their memory with your teammates and with your friends who are still alive? Come and pay your respects. And he walks off, leaving Namor behind, and we'll see if he bothers to show up. Meanwhile, in current time, we see that Namor and Makan are headed somewhere, and they're talking about what Namor has been planning for a really long time, and they're talking about enlisting the help of the Sea Blades, this group that took over a settlement of displaced Atlanteans for a long time. And Mackin says, okay, we're here, and we've been expected. And those Sea Blades are there, and they're saying, I wondered when this day would come when King Namor, quote-unquote, needed their help. Has Atlantis been destroyed again? Have you come to beg for our help? Apparently, this is the leader of the Sea Blades. His name is Karis. And Namor says, well, you once served Emperor Thakor, my grandfather, and you were heroes to the kingdom. And as king, I turned a blind eye to you abdicating your duty and the pillaging that you've done in recent years in the dark corners of the seas, but no longer. It's time to come home. We need you for one final glorious battle. And these Sea Blades, they've had far too much autonomy for far too long. And they're like, we're not going to follow you. What would you even offer us? I remember when you were sent away as a child, you were an embarrassment. So, you know, why should we bother to help you? And Namor says, enough. My offer is simple. Join me or die. And they're like, really? All of us against you? What are you going to do? Are you going to signal the sharks with your blood? And Namor says, this is a serious crime. You're about to commit violence upon your king. And even the most forgiving of reigns, that punishment is the same. It's death. And we see Namor's eyes start to turn black. And all of a sudden, Namor's controlling the water. He is controlling the seawater, and he drains all the water away from this city that the Sea Blades live in. And they're left laying on the seabed floor, gasping for breath because they can't breathe without water. So Namor says, I'll ask you again, will you join me? And Kara says, yes, yes, my king. You know, he can barely grasp it out. And Namor says, good, and allows the water to flow back in. He tells him, you're going to travel with me to Atlantis, and the rest of your Sea Blades will follow. And explain this to all your people, because I won't wait for you, but do not tarry. And Kara says the same question I do. How did you do that? Like, Namor's never been able to control water like that. It's super cool that he can do that. And Namor says, you know what? The only question you need to think about is, how can you serve my king? Yes, I can control water itself now, and my power is greater, and my reach is even farther. So, fall in line, basically. So, yeah, it's a great look for Namor. It's a great level of power for Namor. How he got that ability, I have no idea. And you probably don't either if you didn't read this series, but we'll get answers to some of those questions coming up later. So on the last, or the next couple pages, I should say, we see Namor show up for the burial, and he's actually even wearing an army uniform. He gives Rogers a hug. They bury their lost, and they talk about how tough it is. How tough it is to lose people in battle. Meanwhile, back in present time, we see Jim Raymond visiting Randall, another one of the soldiers that was in that unit that fought alongside Namor and himself and Captain America and Bucky. And he's pretty frail and old. I mean, the guy fought in World War II, so he's in his 90s now. And they're talking about how Namor had saved Randall's life a couple different times, and the memories of that. And then Randall's daughter shows up and says, you know, here's the family album that my dad has all his memories in, but I want to be sure that you realize that he's not entirely there these days. And these albums, they're family heirlooms, but they're really also the only way that his memories are preserved. So I would like to give them to you. I know he's giving them to you to use for your book, but I'd rather they stay here with us because it's just kind of personal. He's like, no, I understand. You know, I can look through them here. That's fine. And as he hands one of them back, a picture falls out, and it turns out it's Namor. And apparently Namor visited Randall after the war during those years when he was still an amnesiac. And Charles Xavier is there in the picture as well. So all of a sudden, Jim Hammond has this mystery on his hands. And Captain America has decided that he is going to go ahead and help Jim, just like Jim Raymond had asked. Like, hey, Namor was our friend. We know he was a hero. Yeah, he's been kind of on the wrong side of things lately, but all anybody ever wants to do is attack him, and nobody's looking for the why. And so we see Tony Stark trying to talk Captain America out of doing this. He says Namor is a massive threat, and Cap's like, well, that's exactly why I'm doing this. And Tony's like, but without the Avengers, that's just stupid. You know, he's crazier than ever. Situation's out of hand. It's going to turn into a war. And, you know, you shouldn't do it. This is an Avengers business. You shouldn't do it on your own. And Cap says it's not Avengers business. It's Invaders business. Because that's who we were when the war was going on. And if Jim is right, Hammond is right, and Namor is still out there on the battlefield, you don't leave a guy behind. So something's wrong with him, something's missing, and we gotta talk him down, we gotta cut through the madness. Otherwise, this could be the end of Namor. So meanwhile, as the Sea Blades are showing up at Atlantis, they see Namor there kind of floating above the city, and they're wondering if what they've really done is throw their lot in with a mad king, because Namor appears to be just talking to somebody, and they're saying the king is mad, Karis, the king is mad. So what does Namor have up his sleeve? How did he gain these incredible powers to control water? Will Jim Hammond and Bucky, who's now the Winter Soldier, and Captain America be able to reach him, to get through to him? Can they remind Namor of the hero he was during the war, and how that may have been the time he felt the closest to fellow humans? I mean, he is half human. I mean, he cared so much about the soldiers that were lost, to the point that he was throwing up walls and talking about them as puny bags of water, which is a very Namor thing to call another human being. But it's a good story. I haven't been the biggest fan of Chip Zdarsky. Absolutely hated his Howard the Duck stuff. But I've read some stuff from him recently that I've started to enjoy more. So, reserving judgment on this, not sure. I am curious, though. It is a compelling story. I do like the dual pacing. Wasn't a huge fan of the dual narrative, although I thought it made sense. I rather would have had, give me all the backstory, give me all the story from the past in the first half of the book, and then give me the modern day story instead of cutting back and forth in between. I felt kind of the same way about the Daredevil issue, although I didn't mention it there. And it might just be because I kind of read these back to back. I was like, really, this again? This narrative plot again? Storytelling device again? So, eh. The art, Carlos Mango. I really enjoyed the Carlos Magno pages. Very detailed, very fine lines. Beautiful underwater work. He handles all the present day stuff. The past stuff is Butch Geis. And it's very much Butch Geis. So great storytelling, really strong lines, very impactful art, but tends not to be as detailed, tends to be a little more muddy. And I don't think that I don't think the inkers do his work any favors. And well, there aren't any inkers, I think that the lack of having an inker, because I've seen Butch's work look much cleaner than this, before. So I think he's one of those artists who benefits from having an inker who can bring out detail, rather than going straight from the pencils to the colors. I just don't think it works for Butch. I think he needs an inker to kind of clean up his style a little bit. So, the other thing I'll mention about the art is the color work from Alex Gramerez. The scenes in the past have a sepia tone to them, which makes a lot of sense when you think about it being back in World War II, as opposed to the current time. The scenes in the present are much richer and more vibrant in color. So good job by the color artist as it pertains to that. So I did enjoy The Invaders. I've always been interested in reading some stories about The Invaders, but never have. And as I mentioned, I'm not the biggest fan of Chip Zdarsky, but I wanted to give his work another try, and I wanted to read Invaders, so this felt like the perfect time. And I did enjoy the first issue, and as soon as I finished it, I was ready for issue two. I was like, bring it on, let's go. Let's find out what happens, especially because I'm so curious about where Namor got those abilities. All right, next we have Ironheart number 2 from Eve Ewing. The art is by Luciano Vecchio. Layouts are by Gioffo. Colors by Matt Milla. And letters by Clayton Cowles. Another one where we're using the flashback. I don't know what it is about the constant use of flashback here, but at least this one only starts off with a flashback. We're seeing Riri Williams back when she was at King College Prep 5 years ago. She's being picked on by some of the other kids, and we see that there's another student there, another girl who kind of stands up for her. And even though she's somewhat out of her element, right? She's Riri Williams. She's a genius. She's being picked on because she's a young kid and she's, you know, already in high school, but yet she's so much younger. And so we all know how terrible high schoolers can be with picking on people. And, you know, if you're younger, you're weaker, they kind of sense that. And so that's why Riri is being picked on. She can't open her locker, gum stuck in the combination, blah, blah, blah. So like I said, this other student kind of stands up for her. Deja Hamilton is her name. And it's just a little bit of a foreshadowing for something that happens at the end of the issue. Then we speed up to present day. We're in Boston. We see that there are some thugs who are shaking down a neighborhood bodega for money, protection money, as it were. And they talk about how, hey, I already made my payment last week. So, hey, we own you. If you want more money, you're going to give more money. And the people in the neighborhood are sick of these thugs terrorizing the neighborhood. And they're kind of trying to stand up to these criminals, saying, what are you going to do? You're going to kill me? So what? I'm old. And then it just so happens that Riri is there as well. She actually frequents this establishment. and she stands up to the goons, takes them out, and the goons go running off, and they thank her for that, and they say, yeah, you know, maybe I should give you guys a distress signal or something. That way, when you need help, I can come running. And they're like, what's the, why? We'd be hitting the button every day. Better just give them what they want. And the older guy's like, don't give in. Ironheart can protect us. Well, no, she can't be here all the time. And she's thinking, well, I wish I could be. There are just so many people who need help. And one of the guys says, well, you do what you can. If they kill me, at least I'll leave a handsome corpse. So Riri's thinking about how unfair it should be, and or how unfair it is, and how the city should be more fair, when she hears a noise outside. And those goons have returned, and they're there for revenge. They're not going to take what Ironheart did laying down. They pull up in a car. They've got automatic machine guns. And for a second, Riri freezes. She is thinking back to, you know, what's happened in her past, the tragedies there. And it ends up being her AI, Natalie, who, you know, screams at her, hey, come back, snap out of it. Get it together, because in this game, we're not going to get out of it if you're not in it, if you're not, you know, in it to win it. So she definitely takes a little bit of damage to her armor, but she's able to subdue the goons, and she makes sure that nobody's hurt. But then she flies off because she's got to go repair her armor, basically. And Natalie, the AI, is saying that was bad. You want to talk about it? And she's like, no. Just give me a full damage report. And as she's trying to fly back to school, her armor starts smoking, and she's like, oh man, just a minor electrical fire, but ends up having to take an emergency landing and take the subway back. And she's sitting there in her armor next to other people in the subway thinking, this is not my day. When she does get back to MIT, she finds that her lab is being visited once again. She's thinking, not this again, Dean Bryant. I thought we had this discussion about unauthorized visitors in my lab. And this Dean Bryant, who seems to be a total douchebag, says these are authorized visitors from Alchemex, who we know is not exactly the most up-and-up company. But he basically tells her, hey, this is an undergraduate lab, and there are costs, and as long as you work at this institution, you play by the rules, which means basically these Alchemex goons are there taking pictures and stealing her work. But although she pretends to placate the dean, what actually happens is her AI, Natalie, says, if it makes you feel any better, they were all on the Wi-Fi, so I hacked their phones and deleted all the pictures and info before they left. And she says, you know what? That does make me feel better. And then gets to work on the damage that was done to her armor that she needs to repair. Meanwhile, Natalie, the AI, lets her know that there's a missing person in Chicago that she may want to be on the lookout for. And it turns out it's Deja Hamilton, her friend. So she decides it's time to take a trip home. And she's there hanging out with her family, trying to figure out what happened to Deja, how she's been missing. And as many feelers as she puts out, she's not able to really find anything out on her own. She learns about a councilman, Thomas Birch, who's running for governor, and he seems to be a little bit shady. And they talk about how his opponent's personal business got leaked to the public. And I mean, the insinuation is that this guy, this Jim Birch, is kind of a shady, back-dealing scumbag of a politician, and he leaked the messages about Jim Clark to the press, and, you know, from his text messages. And so it's all foreshadowing something that's coming up later that we don't fully have the answers to. But what we do find out is that as much as Riri's been trying to find out things on her own, it ends up being her connections and her relationships with the people in her neighborhood that give her a clue. And that's when she finds out that Deja was actually interning for Birch at City Hall. So Riri heads down there, and right as she's approaching City Hall, we see that some kids basically pickpocket somebody's phone and lead Riri on a somewhat of a long chase. And when she finally catches up, it's just a little boy, maybe 10 years old, who says that he's just doing what he told. He was just hungry. He throws the phone to Riri and runs off. When we see two armored goons show up, preventing Riri from chasing the 10-year-old boy any further, and they are able to be knocked out and taken out, and Riri's able to defeat them. But before she can interrogate them, they kind of disappear in some puffs of flame, if you will. So she's able to return the phone to the guy who lost it, and then continue on her quest to find Deja. Meanwhile, we get an Elsewhere in the City where we see those kids that stole the phone are being instructed, I guess you would say, by somebody in the shadows, that, and we're not really sure who it is, but they're saying, you know, I'm supposed to believe you didn't steal the merchandise for yourselves. And they say, no, we tried to, but she was chasing us and we tried to get away. And the figure says, shut up, no one asked for your excuses. Those who fail me are punished. And we see, as he's saying that it appears to be Deja, unconscious, locked up in some sort of cage. So it's clear that she got in over her head. It's not clear if that voice that was instructing them is this Jim Birch, but clearly something going on that's going to have to do with politics and exploiting kids and probably tapping into some of the right versus left and persecution of minorities that we see so much in today's world. So I thought the first issue of Ironheart by Eve Ewing was really great in that it felt very much like a classic superhero comic, with her rescuing hostages from a mad scientist type. It seems in issue two, we're clearly pivoting. It's almost like issue one established that, yes, she's a superhero, but she is young, she is inexperienced, but she does have the makings of being somebody really capable, but she has her own sort of things that she's dealing with. Think back to sort of classic Spider-Man, you know, dealing with school, dealing with peer pressure, dealing with girls, kind of something similar here. You know, she's dealing with school, but it happens to be college this time, and an overbearing dean who doesn't seem to get it, and also struggling to make connections because she is so different, being this, you know, genius level intellect rivaling Tony Stark, but also being a young black teenager who's isolated from her classmates and peers because there's that big age gap. So there's a lot here, and Eve Ewing is really mining that a lot, and I appreciate that. I would have liked a little bit more of those kind of classic superhero kind of stories to establish. I don't know that one issue is enough before we appear to be getting into a more political type story. But it could be that Ewing is going to be able to weave those political machinations in very well and make it feel very superheroic. It's too soon to tell. We saw a little bit of conflict here, but not, you know, a lot in terms of who are these people in Chicago and what powers do they have and what's up with these armored guys that disappeared in the flash of flame. All that is too up in the air. Obviously, we got a little action in the beginning with Riri going up against some, you know, common street hoodlums, if you will. Maybe a little above that, being that they're organized and they have automatic weapons, but still, it's somewhat of a street level thing. So nothing that felt like the villain or the situation that she went up against in the first issue that I enjoyed so much, but still handled really, really well. I think the art is done well also, especially the color work. It's a very brightly colored book. So that kind of feeds into this idea of the innocence and the traditional superheroics, you know, young teenage heroes. You know, I mentioned Spider-Man before, so Matt Miller does a great job. When I saw his name on the book, I knew the color work would be spectacular and so different from what he's done on the Daredevil book with Charles Soule and Ron Garney, where it's very dark, very moody, very crime noir. So goes to show his skill in handling different palettes. All right, up next we have the first issue of the new volume of Marvel Comics Presents. So this is an anthology title. This one is featuring Wolverine, Captain America, and Namor. We've got three features. The first one is Wolverine. It's written by Charles Soule. Pencils are by Paolo Sciarra. Inks by Oren Jr. Color art by Frank D'Armata. And letters by Joe Caramagna. It's a World War II story where we see Wolverine kind of cut loose against some Nazis. It's not a period of time and of Marvel history that we've seen a lot of from Wolverine in the past. So I did enjoy that, and there's not much more to say about it other than I love seeing these different time eras, these different time periods be filled in, where we know Logan was alive at the time, but we don't have a lot of stories about what happened to him then. I mean, this is pretty adamantium. We see when he pops his claws, they're bone claws, and we're going to get more of this story. The fact that this is an anthology makes it a little tough to review when you're just getting a third or a fourth of the story. So I don't want to give away too much other than the fact that this does still feel like Wolverine, although maybe a little less jaded than we've seen him in more recent years. Love the fact that it's bone claws. The art is good, not great. I love the panel layouts. Absolutely love them. I think that's the strength of the art, along with the color work from Frank D'Amata. I don't know that I've seen Paolo Sciarra art before. His faces seem a little soft to me, and that especially doesn't work for me with Wolverine. It works with the female characters in the story, but for Wolverine, I need him to have a little bit more of an edge in his facial features and facial expressions. And I understand, I mentioned that it feels like this Wolverine is a little less jaded. So I could see you wanting to go a little softer, but I think from jump, Logan is just one of those characters where he has a little bit harder edge to his features, and the softness to his features doesn't work for me in this story. The second story is the Namor story. It's written by Greg Pak, you know, incredible, talented writer, written many things that have been incredibly successful and popular. His Kingsway West series from Dark Horse, criminally underrated. World War Hulk, Mech Cadet U, like so many great stories. Art is by Tom Coker. Colors are by Michael Garland, and letters are by Joe Caramagna. So much like the Invader story I talked about previously, this is a World War II story. It's Atlantis. It's 1945. It's Wolverine. It's Namor fighting against Nazi war machines, screaming out Imperius Rex, set in Argentina. And when Namor finds out that he's been what he thinks to be distracted by being sent to Argentina to keep him away from the Pacific Theater where the bombs are being dropped. So the first bomb has been dropped on Hiroshima. When Namor finds out, he confronts the Allies and says, you know, you're telling me this was a strategic strike and it saved the lives of hundreds of thousands of American troops in a ground war, military target, but tell that to the dead babies I saw there, and you meet them in whatever afterlife you have. So he's clearly not happy that things have escalated in his mind. Here go these humans again, killing each other, and now they've escalated it by using a weapon of even, more horror, that kills indiscriminately. And while he's talking to this officer in the U.S. military, he realizes they've got another bomb. And so he flies back to Japan just in time to see the bomb dropped on Nagasaki. And he tries to intercept it, but it blows up as it hits him. And he's basically at ground zero. And then the story jumps forward 3 weeks later. And we see that the Japanese have surrendered. And Namor is among the injured. And I had to go up back and look it up after this, because he's there among the injured. And is he there to be helping? Or was this where his amnesia came from? So come to find out, there's another story that talks about a villain, can't remember his name right now, that was responsible for Namor's amnesia, that had him wandering the world, where he ended up in a flop house in New York City, where Johnny Storm, Human Torch, found him. But maybe that's being changed. Maybe it's being retconned. I'm not really sure. But what's clear is that Namor, despite all his posturing for protection of Atlantis and protection of his people, he does care about people overall. You know, even if it's the Japanese who were on the wrong side of the war in World War II, you know, again, innocents are being killed, babies and children, and Namor's just not okay with that. I mean, the underlying fact of the matter is that he's trying to protect Atlantis, because clearly nuclear weapons are going to damage the entire world, not just the surface world, but Atlantis as well. But he does, you know, as soon as he intuits that that second bomb exists and it's going to be dropped, he immediately flies to Japan and almost gets there in time to stop it. So they don't know what happened to Namor. We see, you know, in the 3 weeks later flash forward, have you found Fury? No. You know, what the heck were you expecting? If Namor was with the bomb when it hit, he's dust by now. Clearly they don't realize how powerful and sturdy Namor is. But if he did get hit with the bomb and he is dead, he's dust and ash like everything else. And then, you know, so be it, they say. Count your blessings, because if Namor were still in the fight, there's no telling if he would still be on the side of the Allies or not, considering how strongly he felt about these nuclear bombs being being dropped. So I don't know if that is a story that's going to continue, because it is one of three stories in the Marvel Comics Presents issue one, but it says end, so we don't get any sense that it's going to continue. I kind of feel like it was put in here just to kind of enrich or maybe set something up for the Invaders series, where I just talked about the first issue. So that might be a part of it. In fact, that Invader series may even refer, go read the story in Marvel Comics Presents number one to fill in some of the backstory. The last story is Marvel Spotlight on Captain America. So another one of the Invaders characters or team members. It's written by Ann Nesenti. We have pencils by Greg Land, inks by Jay Leistein, and colors by Frank Diamata, with letters by Joe Caramagna. And we've got Cap, basically, it doesn't even say what exactly he's doing. He set up some sort of bomb for some reason or another. And he's on his motorcycle. He's driving out of the smoke and the ash and the fire. And he's being followed by one of Tony's drones. And apparently he's kind of out in the middle of nowhere. And as he's making this jump, as he's fleeing this explosion on his motorcycle, there's a young girl on a bike who is kind of following along with what he's doing and tries to make the same move and wipes out. But Captain America sees her wipe out and goes to make sure she's okay, while Tony is saying, I'm sending a jet to pick you up. And he says, don't bother, I'll ride. And Tony's like, it's fine, you're Captain America, I'll send a jet. Cap's arguing with him, don't waste the fuel. And, you know, I want to ride on the back roads. This is how I get in touch with who, you know, America is, who the citizens are. And again, Tony's arguing, you're Captain America, your time is more valuable than that. So Cap ends up with a flat tire based on the kind of the braking maneuver he needed to do to get away from the explosion. And so this girl offers that she has some used tires at her house, and Cap is more than happy to, or more than welcome to come and make a repair. the only thing she would ask is that he would take a look at her dirt bike because she's got some issues with it. So not exactly sure when Cap became an expert in dirt bikes, but he does manage to fix hers, which doesn't please the young girl's mother, because she's been telling the girl all along that it needs this expensive part that they just can't afford to be fixed. But what we come to learn in the story is that the reason that she's saying that is because she doesn't want her daughter to keep going down the path she's going. Her daughter's a bit of a daredevil, fan of Evel Knievel, is always constantly setting up these stunts, and she's just worried that her daughter's going to get hurt. So Cap hangs out for another day and says that he'll talk to the girl and see if he can get her to kind of calm down. And when Cap does go and talk to her, what he finds out is that she meticulously plans everything. She sets up things for safety. And basically what it comes down to is this girl's got to be who she's got to be. And Cap even tells her mother that when her mother shows up there at the scene of her stunt, saying, well, that was her first big stunt and there will be more. Were you going to be around for the next one to make sure she's okay? And Cap says, you know, I hear you. But she's got to be who she is. She is who she is, and you need to let her be that. And then he tells the young girl, Kelly, hey, Kelly, don't forget what I told you. I've got my eye on you. And that's the end of the story. So much like the second story, it says end, ends with the word end. So I guess that's the end of the story. Is this some sort of way to introduce this young girl, Kelly, who likes to jump on motorcycles, into the Marvel Universe? And she's going to end up being some sort of hero. Will we get her showing up somewhere else just as somebody who is in danger and needs Cap's help? I'm not sure. I mean, it was a fun story. I kind of just didn't see the point of it. Gregland art, so it looks pretty good on the close-up kind of stuff. But the background, the setting shots, it gets a little sloppy. So we all know about Greg Land at this point. Guy uses a lot of photo reference, and when he does, his stuff looks spectacular. When he doesn't, it's a little bit more messy. So, I mean, overall, it's a fun story. It's an enjoyable story. But I just end up feeling like, what's the point? Overall, I did enjoy this Marvel Comics Presents issue. I don't know if Marvel's canceled it at this point. I haven't heard of any Marvel Comics Presents issues coming out. So maybe it didn't sell that well, although they did introduce a Wolverine-related character, and some of the issues blew up and went to second printings. So I'm just not sure where we are. I would like to think we could do a Marvel Comics Presents series like we did back in the day. And I think, I want to say the one back in the day was weekly, or might have been bi-weekly. I think it can work. I think it's a way to give people, you know, little doses of stories if it comes out. I think it would have to be more than a monthly basis. I think it would at least have to be twice a month. So it's coming out every other week. So you did get enough, because you do get such a small piece of story, such a small chunk of story. You do need it to come, you need it to come out a little more frequently so that it keeps the momentum going. But I love the idea of Marvel Comics Presents, where you're giving younger creators and creators that are trying to break in a voice. They don't all have to be by creators that we don't know, but you know, maybe one of them is by a penciler we don't know, or somebody that's newer, doesn't have a lot of experience. Maybe one of the other stories is written by somebody with a veteran penciler. So that way you can get these this new generation of talent some experience, and you're exposing Marvel readers to more Marvel characters that they may not read on a normal basis. So love the idea of Marvel Comics Presents. Love the package. Love the fact that it's, you know, Charles Soule and Ann Nesenti, you know, Greg Pak, really big names when it comes to writers. I imagine it's a challenge for them though to write a little bit shorter of a narrative, although they know it's going to continue. Maybe they're writing it as a regular issue and then just breaking it up in half. Not sure how the process works, but great idea to bring Marvel Comics Presents back. I just don't know if it's still back. And if it's not, it should be, because I think it can work in the current environment. All right, the last book I'm going to talk about is Daredevil number 18, written by Charles Soule, art by Ron Garney, colors by Matt Milla. Like I was talking about, the incredible crime noirish looking colors of Matt Milla here, as opposed to the more primary, bright colors he did on Ironheart. Just incredible, incredibly talented color artist. Letters by Clayton Cowles, and this is continuing the Charles Soule run on Daredevil, which I think is just such a absolutely incredible look at the character. Just such a deep dive into who Matt Murdock is, not only as a hero, but as a lawyer, being that Charles is a lawyer as well. So we know that in the last issue, we saw Matt finally starting to tell the tale of how he put the cat back in the bag, how he was able to resume his secret identity when everybody had known. So he's given his confession, talking about the Purple Children, giving us a recap as he's telling the priest, for anybody who's not familiar with Zebediah Kilgrave and his power, where he basically can make anybody do anything. So it's Purple Part 2, and we also get a recap of how Kilgrave was able to escape from prison the latest time, and then we get to the main part of the story, which picks up where it left off with last issue, with a couple of the Purple Children showing up at Daredevil's door. Obviously, he lets them in because they're being pursued by just random people who are under the spell of the Purple Man and who want to catch these kids. And so sends them upstairs where his girlfriend Kirsten is and says, you know, hide them, keep them safe. And eventually this mob of people literally breaking bones, breaking hands and wrists and what have you against his door while trying to get in, break through the front door and start heading up the stairs. So Murdock puts Kristen and the two Purple Children into the safe room, changes into Daredevil and starts trying to stop this mob, stop these people who have been sent after the children, but trying to do it in such a way that he can't, that he won't hurt them, because they can't stop and they won't stop. They're under Purple Man's spell, and all they know is what he wants and what they command. So he tries to do it at first without hurting them, and then realizes it's all about degrees. He's going to have to hurt them to some extent, to incapacitate them in order to protect them, because otherwise they're going to kill themselves. Because it's one thing to bang against wood and nails and glass and try to fight their way into Murdock's house, but when it comes to, you know, a 4 to 6 inch steel door that they're going to have to batter their way through to get into the safe room, they'll break themselves upon it. You know, like waves upon a rock, they won't stop. And so he is finally able to knock them all out. And he tells Kristen, hey, call 911, get an ambulance here before they wake up. Tell them to put these people in restraints and make sure that they're unconscious when they, and restrain before they wake up so they can't hurt themselves any further. And then Daredevil goes to the two kids and says, okay, what's going on? You kids are supposed to stay apart, right? Because that's the whole thing about the Purple Children. They don't have any powers on their own. When you bring them together, they have power. And then when you bring them together in the presence of the Purple Man, that amplifies his power even more. So Daredevil said, you know, I split you up to keep you from going purple and to keep the Purple Man from coming after you. And they say, yeah, we tried, but we stayed in touch, and then Jamie stopped emailing us back, and then Connor, and you know how we can kind of feel each other? So Joe and I, we came here to find them, and then when we were getting close to them, those people started chasing us, and Joe knew you were staying here because of the internet and because your identity is known, and so we thought you could help us save them. So they go up to the rooftops, and with the help of the Purple Children being able to sense each other, they're able to track down where the other Purple Children are. And what they find in an abandoned warehouse is this big machinery with a star, with a big control panel in the middle of the star. And at each of the points of the star is a purple gem. Three of them are lit up already, because apparently the Purple Man has already captured three of the Purple Children, and he has basically put them in these crystals, these gem-like pods, and he's amplifying their power. So as soon as the purple children see that their three siblings are imprisoned, they say, okay, we got this. We have power from the others. We're strong enough. We'll be able to save our siblings. And Daredevil's thinking to himself, I should have seen this coming. Their brothers and sisters are being held captive by this monster, and they're just kids. They have no impulse control, and they have no fear either. They don't realize what they're going up against. And no sooner do they try to use their powers on the purple man that he says, oh, thanks. Glad you're here. Appreciate the effort. Joe the boy and Shala the girl, I have additional powers of my own. Yeah, all five of you are together again, and maybe you would have enough power to resist me, but the fact that I have this machinery which amplifies everything, it's given me all I need to defeat you. And actually what he's done here is he's used the power of the three purple children he already has to amplify his own to take over Daredevil. And so even though he's not able to take over his purple children, it's actually Matt Murdock, it's actually Daredevil that pushes them over the rail onto the ground to the feet of the purple man, and then grabs them from behind and says, all right, here we go. You're now in the hands, in the clutches of the purple man. And purple man is standing behind Daredevil saying, shall we play a game? And as Daredevil is relating this story to the priest, he does say, Kilgrave can be beaten. You just have to have a strong enough will to resist him. And we've seen Daredevil resist a purple man in the past. But you have to see yourself clearly. You have to know what you're going to do. And it's not easy. And the fact of the matter is, Daredevil was lost. As strong as Matt Murdock's will is, as strong as his sense of self is, and his ability to resist the purple man, when it's amplified by three of the five purple children, it overcomes Matt. And it also might have to do with how much self-doubt and unsurety, insecurity that Matt has right now. You have to have a sense of self. You have to have strong will. You can resist, but only if you are single-minded in your focus and you are basically confident and sure in your own skin. And we know, based on the beginning of the story that Matt was telling the priest about how unsure he's been of himself, how ever since his identity's been revealed, he hasn't been able to be Matt Murdock the lawyer, because the fact that Matt Murdock is Daredevil colors everything. It colors everything. He can't practice law. He can't defend people. He can't even be a witness as Daredevil on the stands, because everything is called into question. So all his life, Matt Murdock has fought for justice, both as a lawyer and as Daredevil, and that's been what has defined him. And now all of a sudden, that dynamic has been stripped away. And so he's never been more unsure of who he is. So it's a great challenge for Matt Murdock, a wonderful storytelling device for Charles Soule to use to give another challenge for Matt to overcome. All of a sudden, he can't be a lawyer. That part of his identity and that part of his life has been stripped away. He can be Daredevil, but because his identity as Daredevil is known, he's lost that protection that the anonymity of the secret identity gives him. Just like the anonymity of the internet these days gives people the perceived freedom to say and do whatever they want without consequence. It's kind of the same thing when you have a secret identity. You're not worried about being attacked in your home. You're not worried about your loved ones. You're not worried about the fact that these criminals can claim, hey, I was attacked by Matt Murdock and I'm going to sue him and he's lying about, you know, whatever I said, my word against his, kind of like the tombstone thing that we saw in the previous issue. So again, a great idea from Charles Soule. I feel like his entire Daredevil run is peppered with these ideas of a new way to look at things, new challenges for Matt Murdock, new ways of looking at what it is to be a superhero, to be a lawyer. And now we're getting to see Soul's take on the classic Daredevil villain Purple Man, who is incredibly powerful when you think about it, can get anybody to do anything he wants. So, I mean, that level of power, you wonder why the guy just doesn't just retire and live life, a life of luxury. Well, we know why he's, and it's even talked about a little bit in this issue, how he does do that from time to time, kind of disappears from view and seems to just relax. But he's so depraved that he can't live that life, or he gets bored, basically. So, again, the Charles Soule run on Daredevil is epic. I think it came to a conclusion too soon, because I know Charles had more stories that he wanted to tell about Daredevil and Murdoch. And in my mind, so good. Some of my favorite Daredevil stories of all time. Some of my favorite Daredevil work. And in my mind, just leave Soule on there until he's done. But I know they wanted to bring Zdarsky on, and that's fine. You know, I don't own Marvel Comics, and whatever editorial likes to make changes. I get that. And then it gives you a chance to start up with a new number one. But I just would have loved to see Charles do more, because I know he had more ideas. And his ideas for Matt and for Daredevil are so fun, especially for a character that's been around as long as Daredevil has. To still be coming up with new ideas and new challenges, it's refreshing. So always recommend Charles' run on Daredevil. The Ron Garney art is spectacular. It's very moody. It's very crime noir, which, you know, suits Daredevil ever since the Frank Miller days and the Lee Weeks days. So can't complain about that. And I've already talked about Matt Miller a lot in this episode about how incredible his color work is. Obviously this issue, a lot of purple, but it works. There's a tendency with the Purple Man for it to look kind of weird. Because, I mean, I don't know why they chose purple. But Matt does a great job of it clearly is purple, but it's subdued enough that it still works with the palette that he's using and complements the other colors he's using to keep it kind of dark and moody and in that crime noir space. So really, really great issue, the Purple Man story arc and the idea and the way Charles Soule puts the cat back in the bag and gets Daredevil his secret identity back is truly inspired, because Mark Waid left him with a mess in terms of that. You know, couldn't do the Doctor Strange thing, couldn't do the Mephisto thing, so many different reboots and what have you. It's all been done, and Charles managed to come up with something original, which is really, really cool. So I really enjoyed this issue, and I hope you all enjoyed this podcast and enjoyed me talking about these Marvel issues for Marvel Monday. So as always, thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll talk to you next time.
You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.